The Arthur Thompson, real one. Yes, Mr. Thompson, can you just tell me, when were you born?
I was born the 12th of February 1925.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
Two brothers. One brother is retarded, I told you.
Oh, I see. Now, where were you staying then?
I was staying at Siglap, Palm Road, number 14.
Can you tell me something about your life before the Japanese occupation?
Yes, I was, just before then I was schooling. I was in the senior Cambridge examination, that's my final. And the exams had commenced. And what happened was this, I was in the Victoria Institution, that was my center for St. Patrick's schoolboys. What happened was this, Sunday night, I would say, make it more correct, Monday morning, early hours of Monday morning, Singapore was bombed with the first raid of Japanese bombers. And when I went to school, we saw ambulances and ARPs, they call air raid precaution wardens, were moving around the school compound downstairs. Our examination hall was upstairs. So we went up, teacher says, the war was broken out, and told us what we were to do when the siren comes on. We're doing our history of the British Empire, and when the siren goes, all you do is to cover your papers, examination papers, turn it over, and get under the desk.
Yeah, before that, did you know anything about the Japanese?
Well, we didn't expect this. This is really something unexpected. I knew a little bit about the Japanese when they attacked China and were fighting in Shanghai and places like that. No, that's about all we knew about the Japs. Because the Japs had shops here, and I believe they were all spies. Those who had the shops in Singapore, like Hey Baba, 10-cent store. You know, we've seen them in the shops only, and that's all we knew about the Japs.
Did you know about the first air raid?
Yeah. What happened was, my neighbors, they're Arabs, they're very rich, a lot of money, and they rang up, told my mother about in early hours in the morning. My mother called my mother to the house, and she had a shock of her life, and she saw them with bright lights on, taking all the jewelry. They had a lot of jewelry, you know, rings and bangles and everything, getting ready to move out fast. And they were the ones that broke the news. My mother came on the radio, see?
Were there any preparation made by your family?
Well, no preparation. We didn't think we'll evacuate anywhere. I mean, these Arabs moved out, and so did the rich Chinese next to them. The man who owned Ho Hong oil mills, he moved out, his family, and most of the people went, and I think we were the only people that stayed back, my family.
Why?
Well, my mother, as I told you, she's a fortune teller, and she has feelings. Comes to her not to move, then we listen to her, you see. She has this kind of feelings that come to her, you know, being a fortune teller. She gets this, I don't know what, sixth sense, what do you call it, you know. And that's how we stayed back on her advice. She says, I feel nothing will happen to us. We just stay here.
In your neighborhood, were your family the only one there?
Oh, yes. On the main, you see, what happened was, along the main road, East Coast Road, where we came, from the main road down to the sea, most of the people were evacuated, thinking that the Japs would come by the sea. You know? And they thought they move inland, they'd be safer. But on the contrary, moving inland was worse. The Japs came from the mainland, and a lot of bombing was going on in the parts where they had moved to, and shelling later on, you know.
Did you shift to another new place?
No, we didn't. Only after the Japs landed, when they asked us to move out. You know what happened? The Japs wanted all the houses facing the sea. They drew a line from the main road, East Coast Road, Mountbatten Road, right down to the sea. They closed all Mountbatten Road to the public. And that was all for the military.
So where did you shift?
Well, yes, we shifted a house opposite the, opposite East Coast Road, on the opposite side of East Coast Road. The mainland, more on the towards mainland, in mainland.
Who helped your family with the shifting?
Oh, well, I tell you, we knew some, we knew a chap who was working for the government, PWD, one of the inspectors, health inspectors in Indian. He had some of these, rubbish carts. You carry rubbish in the morning with two wheels and a man pushes it. But we used that to carry our furniture.
How did you manage to get this new place?
Now, there's something very interesting I'll tell you. Before we shifted, the first few days when the Jap, before, we had a European couple, as I said, staying opposite. And I saw this and I heard, and I didn't see them being killed. A lot of Chinese were taken, as you know. And we looked through the back, I looked through the back, myself and my brother, through the window, our kitchen window, and we saw lorry loads of Chinese with their hands tied behind their back. And they were brought to somewhere near my place, a little further up. There's a hill, you know. And they went up the hill, and they were told to run down the hill. As they were going push down the hill, they were machine gunned. I heard that machine gun, like cracker firing, machine gun shooting. And we had tears in our eyes, we knew what was happening then. And the same person that lent us the cart, he had to go and put some oil, because the bodies were not properly buried. He dug a hole and waited, put the bodies in a hole and covered them, because the bodies were getting rotten and the stench also, you see. Being a health inspector, he had oil, this oil that you put in drains for mosquitoes, and he poured some oil over the body so he wouldn't, disease or the bodies were rotting, see.
Yes, Mr. Thompson, when did you evacuate from your old place?
I evacuated, say, about a year and a half later, after the fall of Singapore.
So that's a 1 year's lap, but can we just go back again, okay, before fall of Singapore? Do you know that that Singapore is going to be surrendered, is going to surrender herself to the Japanese?
Well, over the news, we heard about what was happening in Malaysia. Places were going one after the other, and they were in Johor, and things were getting very bad. But somehow or other, the British administrators here thought that Singapore would never fall to the Japs, because we were strongly fortified, you see, and we had hopes that they'll hold out to them, hold out to the Japanese. When the fighting started in Singapore, things got very bad. They admitted that they had, most probably will have to surrender.
So how did you know definitely that Singapore has fallen to the Japanese?
We heard it over the air. The news broadcast, Singapore has fallen. Sad broadcast made by the governor and stuff. The governor told everybody, hey, we have surrendered.
So what were the family's reactions?
My mother cried when she heard it. We were very sad.
Then what about your father, your brothers?
No, my father died years ago, many, many years ago, when I was only 10 years old, My brothers and myself, well, nothing more we could do. We just checked up on our stocks of food supplies, how long we could hold out, like if anything happens. But what we're interested is our food, is enough food, enough rice. We stocked up a lot of rice.
Where do you get this this stock of food from?
Well, before when the war started, we bought up. We were told to keep ample stocks of rice, and I believe the British stocked up about 7 months' supply of rice in Singapore, just in case we were, we were surrounded and we couldn't get any supplies coming in. We could survive at least for 7 months or so, 6-7 months' supply of rice in Singapore.
Yeah, my question is that. Where did you manage to get the food, do the provision stores still sell them, knowing that the Japanese
is the landed? Provision stores did carry on business. The Chinese shops opened, the bakery near my place opened, and of course, there was a long queue. You had to rush and get your stuff. you know, people had to rush and queue up. It was a general group. Mm-hmm. And then they started issuing cards, pinky, you know, like cards for supply food. With that card you get, you know, you put your name and so on. That's the way they did it, in that way. And of course you could go to market, it was not very far. And that was all done by my youngest brother.
No, you were mentioning about those cards called what? Tinky.
They're called Tinky. You know, in Chinese meaning, not identity card, card that entitles you to get provisions. I'll give you an instance now. They say, tomorrow, market will be issuing tapioca. That's what we wanted. And maybe soap too, we needed, you see. And you had to bring your card along with you. And depending on the number of people in that family, you get that quantity. Ration, that's a ration you get.
Now, who's responsible to issue this card, and who started this form, this system?
The Japs, or the Japanese military administrators. You know, the Japs came here, and they started some kind of government. Mm. Then they started issuing their own notes, banana notes, as they call them. Mm-hmm. You know, because they had banana pictures of banana trees. That's why they call them banana notes. Japanese notes of Singapore, that was supposed to be where they concerned with legal tender for them, issued by the military.
Yeah, and what were the prices of food like then?
Oh, very expensive. Black market was rampant here, you know. If you wanted to buy anything in the black market, where you paid a lot of money. One more thing I want to tell you. Of course, British money had its value. You understand? They had its value. Now, if you had British money with you, and you could get a lot of things with it.
Why?
Because they said that's valued more than the Japanese currency, Japanese notes, the banana notes. They didn't have faith in them. Well, people knew that the British will come back one day. How long that'll be, we won't know at that moment, you see. And they had the value. British currency notes. That's why they held on to them as much as they could. We held on to our British currency notes, but we couldn't help it, and we had to dispose of. Say you change the $10 British money for $100 Japanese, maybe, you see, that in that ratio.
Yeah. Just now you did mention that your younger brother did the shopping for the family.
Yeah.
Why is it not the elder brothers?
Because we were fair. He was darker in complexion. He's the darkest one a lot. He has my mother's complexion.
Mm-hmm. Why?
So, being young, the Japanese did not disturb any young children, you know. And then they might pass him off as a Malay. As I told you, the Malays collaborated. And they were ones that had a lot of freedom to move around here and there. You understand? And they put the song quotes on, and then they thought, they welcomed the Japs in, as you know. And they were responsible also for going around and showing the Japs where to get the girls and things like that. No?
So, in that case, what did you do on the first few days after the fall of Singapore?
Well, nothing much that I could do. I just sat down and read books, maybe, to pass my time. We were listening to the news, anything we could get to. Then the Japanese started broadcasting their propaganda.
Were people allowed to move freely about in town,
yeah,
along the
that's
neighborhood?
Funny thing. The people did move around freely in Geylang when I went shopping. And they were still scared the first few days, you know, the roads were deserted. And a few buses started running on the road then. And the buses couldn't, not many buses, because, you know, they're going short of oil to fuel. That's the main thing. And I'm coming to it now, the taxis that we had, and they had no fuel, so they improvised some kind of a cylinder behind the taxi, and they used coal to propel the taxi. Then the taxis took out their seats, you know, the cushion seats you had, upholstery, and put wooden benches inside so you can hold more passengers. So you can take 6, 7, 8 people in one taxi, all cramped up in the taxi. And they even had a little platform at the back of the taxi where you could stand on and hold on to the back of the taxi. But that was one of the dangers.
Now, who make use of these taxis?
Well, the people who wanted to go down. Yeah, the thing is this. All Tanjung Katong Road was blocked, you know. Mountbatten Road was blocked. Joo Chiat Road was okay, you know, East Coast Road, you had to turn all the turn in Joo Chiat Road. And then the main trunk road was, as I say, all along Geylang. The taxis and buses were running around Geylang, was the main trunk road. The Japanese didn't touch that part of it. The military occupied towards the sea, as I told you. Yeah? And that goes right down to North Bridge Road, South Bridge Road, Tanjung Pagar, and down back again. Our buses and taxis. Hmm? They had a few taxis, not very many.
Mm.
A few buses running on the road.
Are they expensive to commute in taxis?
They had trams in those days too, you know, but the buses, you know, the omnibuses they had, traction company buses, and trams too, a few trams running along the road. Trams, of course, run by electricity.
Mm.
And we paid in Japanese currency.
Yeah, do you know how much is it per trip? Like, let's say from Katong to Tanjung Pagar.
That's something I...
Yeah, okay.
I don't remember.
Now, when was your first encounter with the Japanese? When was your first encounter with the Japanese?
Well, the first encounter, as I told you before, was the second day after the fall of Singapore. When I was sitting outside the veranda at my house, and the car passed and stopped because they spotted me, a fair person, see?
Mm.
And they got down, a few soldiers and officers, about four or five of them, got off the car. They came in. And I called out my mother. My mother and my brothers were inside. And mother came out and looked at them. She got a fright. Some of them had, you know, flaps at the back of their head. These were wicked looking with beards. You can see unshaven, mustache and beard. And they came in and they looked around. And they saw something that was American. And they got very angry. And they spoke, you know, in Japanese, saying that the Americans are very bad people, you know.
Mm.
Because they were very angry with the Americans, more angry with the Americans than they were with the British, actually.
Why? Do you know why?
Well, what I think is this. It's the Americans who, you know, the Pearl Harbor incident, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And they know the Americans are really going to hit out at them later.
Mm. Now, what were you doing then when the Japanese came to your place? What were you doing?
I was just sitting outside doing nothing. It was the afternoon. Say about 2 o'clock, you know, just after lunch, resting outside, you know, getting some fresh air maybe.
And what were your impressions on them then?
Well, we were a bit scared, you know. We've never seen these Japanese soldiers before, and we were all feeling scared a bit, maybe thinking that these people might shoot us and do some harm. Because we already heard about the rape and the killings in China.
Mm.
That's one thing we knew about them. We had information about what they did in other places in China. We heard a bit about Malaya, what happened in Malaya before this. Some news came through, so we were on the lookout.
Now, I believe that the Japanese did ask the people to go to a certain police station to register themselves. In particular, the Eurasians and the Europeans. Did you go to...
That was the Europeans, yes. Europeans. You see, that European person, the officer staying opposite my house and his wife, I believe he was a British intelligence, he told me.
Mm.
British intelligence. He had a revolver and he hid it under the house when the Japs came. You know, he buried it.
Mm.
And he was very, very annoyed. And I believe many of them were annoyed. They said they were very badly let down. The British didn't tell him exactly what to do, you know, get them prepared and all that.
Mm.
Just surrendered and never information as to what they were to do. So he was at a loss as to what he was to do, whether to go, come or stay. And he had to ask some Japanese officers who came around, visited him. He says, it's best you go. And what they did is they gave him a piece of paper, I think, and wrote some Japanese characters saying that allow this car in, don't stop him. That's the past. The Japs were very fond of doing those things in those days, giving you papers, sticking on the front door of your house so the other soldiers who came and officers, they won't disturb you, won't touch you. If you had that and you had a red chop on it, you're safe. You see, given by one of the military officers. They could read Japanese then. So what he did, he took his wife, himself, took the car, put all his few things, clothes inside, left all the rest behind, and he went to convent school. Some of them were in Joo Chiat police station, some were in Katong Convent.
Mm.
The nearest place for him would be Katong Convent. So he got down, the story I heard later when I met him, told his wife to get in, he started his engine, and bang the car against the tree so you can't use it. Smashed it up.
So do you know what's the outcome? Did she go to the convent to register?
Yes. I didn't go. He went and he was interned. Well, the sad part of it, his wife died. And that, you know, and in Changi Hospital during the internment for want of medicine. No medicine, is it?
Oh,
and she had some cancer or something like that. She needed the violet ray, you know, something, some violet ray treatment, which she could not get. And when he went to see his wife in the hospital, two Japs of soldiers with bayonets watching over him, you know, to see what he was doing. That's what I heard when he was Changi.
Do you know what did he do after that?
Well, after the war. Yeah.
No.
When he went in, this is what happened. In Joo Chiat police station and some in Katung Convent, a lot of Europeans were there.
Mm.
They had to go to Changi jail. That was their former, that was their final internment. The camp was be Changi prison.
Mm.
So I looked out to my window again. We used to always look out through a window. We've got a lot of coconut trees. Now houses weren't built then, all empty land. And we could see a lot of these Europeans marching, walking. They were made to walk into the Changi.
Mm.
Only 3/4 way, before they reached Changi, they carried they took the women and children in the some lorries and trucks. I saw them, you know, with poles on their shoulders, carrying their things, the barangs. They used kumud pots, you know, to cook their tea, you know. Yeah, really. They used to make it clean and use that for making boiling water for the tea. What had they? They had no utensils and things like that, you know. Improvised. Some of them took a helmet, steel helmets they found, and used that for cooking. It's true.
Now, do you know whether any of those Europeans ever did come back to their home again? Like, for example, your neighbor, the British intelligence.
No, he didn't come back to home. He straight away went and got a job. You see, after the war, they were asked if they wanted to be repatriated.
Mm.
And they were all paid for by the British government, those who were British. And the Americans looked after the Americans and Australians and so forth. And we were local people. We were not thinking of going anywhere else. We stay in Singapore, come back to our home.
Yeah, this is something that interests me here. Why didn't you give yourself up, you know? Because especially when they asked most of the Europeans to go and sign up, to go and register in the police stations or in the convent.
They didn't ask, actually. You know, there's no broadcast over here. The British should have done that, huh? I think so. They should have announced it over the air, something with all the nationals. But they didn't. Some felt they had to go, they went, that's all, on their own.
Mm.
They thought they should be interned, I suppose, you see. No one came to tell them you had to go and so on. Because this couple thing in front of my house, he didn't go in immediately. He remained out for a couple of days, you know.
Mm. I see. Now, were there any change in your neighborhood then? Were there any changes in your neighborhood when the Japanese took over Singapore?
Well, no, there were not many people living towards the seaside. There was not so many people living. A lot of local people. And they went to the shops to get their bread and they came home, did nothing and so on. Fishermen dare not go out later, when everything was calmed and cooled down. They went to ship catching their fish, staying at the sea, you know, fishermen. And the others just stayed back. The shops opened for business. And they closed the shutters, brought the shutters down pretty early. By 6 o'clock in the evening, hardly anybody moves along the road, they're scared. Even the Japs themselves, I noticed, they won't go out at night. People might kill them or something. It was very quiet, everything was still. Like a curfew.
What kind of nationalities were staying around your estate then?
Well, we had Chinese, Malays, a few Indians sprinkling. The Indians were Indian laborers, PWD workers. They stayed in their quarters. They came out to see what he'd do also for us. And Chinese, we had Chinese, you know, and we had a few, some Malays also in Malay Kampong.
Now, how did you know that the Japanese order has been established in Singapore? Yeah, that you know?
The papers started coming out.
Mm-hmm.
They call it the Shonan Shimbun. Seonen was a name given for Singapore. Seonen Shimbun, in Japanese, Shimbun means paper.
Mm.
Like they have the SIE Shimbun in Japan, you know. Daiichi Shimbun. meaning paper, newspaper.
Were there any changes in your lifestyle now that, in your family lifestyle?
Well, no, we just stayed on, and we were short of money. We had to sell what we had, like jewelry, parted off with that, and we parted off with some good tablecloths, expensive tablecloths, bed sheets, curtains, you know, some clothing we had. First of all, jewelry went. My mother parted off a lot of jewelry to get some money to live with. Sold that.
So, how did you get your food?
We couldn't go and work. Food, as I told you, my brother was going to buy some fish. Fish is a bit expensive, but still he managed to get some. And to come back to it now, after we moved out, you know, to the other house, I started to grow my own vegetables. Then I was self-supporting in vegetables and tomatoes, tapioca. And I did it as a barter trade with the fishermen. I gave my vegetables in exchange for fish. And that helped us a long way.
If you want to get your provisions, where would you go and get it?
We couldn't get any more provisions after that time. All tin provisions were all taken up, stocked up, finished. What we could get was something like vegetables in the market, tapioca. What else have we got? Some salt, maybe rice. Rice was rationed also.
Who does the marketing?
My brother, my youngest brother, because first and foremost, he was youngest. And then Japanese are not disturbing the young boys, you know, children. And being darker than the two of us, he did running around. He used to go to the shop, go to the bakery, queue up for bread every day. And he'll go to the seaside, see if he can get the fish from the fishermen. Go to the shop and buy some vegetable, maybe the marketplace, and go get some vegetables for us, onions, salt, and things we needed. And once I remember my mother and my brother trekking up the hill, you know, the back of Changi, to get onto Changi Road, there's some hills and